Our next speaker will be Dr. Mitch Cohen, speaking on an update on coagulopathy.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here. I appreciate the invitation. Oscar is a difficult person to follow. I do it a different way. If given less time, I'm just going to go faster. So I'm going to try to give a broad overview of a huge topic in 10 minutes. And interestingly, more and more people are not talking about coagulopathy per se, but talking about blood failure, which I think is actually a really good term to describe what's going on. And when we resuscitate patients, I think it's important to discuss and think about what are we actually trying to do, right? So clearly we as surgeons are trying to stop bleeding. And we're trying to treat coagulopathy by our resuscitation practices. We're also trying to prevent a coagulopathy. But more importantly, I think, in this day and age where people who bleed to death are really bleeding to death from a giant hole in their aorta, not necessarily from biology, they're bleeding to death from physics, we're trying to treat endotheliopathy or a dysregulated inflammation or dysregulated immune function. There's not a really great word for it, but we all know what that patient looks like, right? They're that difficult patient in the corner bed of the ICU, progressive organ systems petering out one by one. Eventually, they get a second hit, they get infected, they get the dwindles. And establishing a trajectory away from that as opposed to toward that is a lot of what we do with resuscitation. And in the era of personalized medicine, which I think is more apropos to what we do in trauma than, frankly, our cancer colleagues who've done really beautiful work in that area, we need to remember that it's not the same in patient to patient, and it's not the same, frankly, in the same patient minute to minute. It rapidly evolves. Coagulation cascade, sequential protease activation, you get caught there at the bottom if you're one of those people that has memorized that, regurgitated onto an exam, and then forgotten it. I'm here to tell you that it's wrong, and it really looks a lot more like this. This is what you should have memorized in biochemistry or medical school. This is a network topological representation of coagulation. It's a pretty complex interactome, and we understand more and more every day that it gets more and more complex. Our understanding of coagulopathy after trauma has come a long way. This was from the early 80s. Jeff Kashuk from the Denver group, long before I joined them. A hand-drawn description of coagulopathy, this lethal triad, this understanding that coagulation abnormalities were because of what we did to patients. That's what we used to think, right? We pumped them full of cold crystalloid. They got diluted. They got cold. They became acidotic, and this lethal triad would cause coagulopathy. We now know that not to be true, and a lot of it came from this paper and another paper from Jana McLeod, contemporaneously published in the early 2000s, suggesting there's an endogenous biologic response that causes patients to be coagulopathic. And what does this mean? This acute traumatic coagulopathy occurs in about a quarter to a third of patients. This data is remarkably consistent, single center, multi-center, military, civilian. If you are severely injured and you're in shock, you are coagulopathic. It doesn't really matter whether you measure it by conventional coagulation tests, INR, PTT, or viscoelastic tests, TEG or ROTEM. The data is remarkably consistent. If you have that, you die more, about four times more often with a mortality rate somewhere between 20 and 50% over a baseline of 10%. If you live, you do worse. You need more blood. You spend more time in the ICU. You end up with more organ failure. You end up with more infection. There are multiple different mechanisms for this. We now understand this is not one entity, but likely multiple different phenotypes. Our group has worked on activated protein C. Other groups have described fibrinolysis, problems with fibrinolysis, both hyperfibrinolysis and fibrinolysis shutdown, where you have too little. I'll talk about that in a second. We know that despite the fact that our platelet counts are normal, and we look at the CBC and we see 200, 300, 400,000 platelets, and we don't bat an eye, that half of those patients have platelets that are numerically normal but don't work. And it's maybe associated with factor depletion. There's a little controversy about that. A complex slide here, but essentially our patients go from a hypocoagulable but probably anti-inflammatory state to a hypercoagulable and pro-inflammatory state. And that happens pretty rapidly, right? It's sexy to talk about all of our patients bleeding to death, but we all know that a bigger problem that we face every day in our ICUs is hypercoagulability, right? VTE events. And this transition happens really, really quickly. We call this a maladaptive response to trauma because, you know, we're not meant to evolutionarily survive getting shot, stabbed, or run over. You need about 500 million years of selection pressure for that. We've made trauma survivable for about 50. So we have, 490, I don't know, it's a lot of years left to go. Oscar could probably calculate that for us, how many more years we need to be evolutionarily adapted. What's the body doing? It's activating a ton of this stuff to try to keep itself alive through the acute phase. We in modern medical care make it possible to see the sequelae of that too much of a good thing response. That too much of a good thing response looks like an anticoagulated patient, looks like someone bleeding in the middle of the night when we're trying to stop the bleeding in the operating room. And then that too little of a good thing response later looks like that difficult patient in the corner bed of the ICU, their organ systems petering out, big clot problems, and later infection. And what we really want is a balanced response. We don't want too much one way. We don't want too much the other way. We want a balanced response. The other thing that I will just talk very, very briefly about is that we now understand that there's a sterile inflammatory response to trauma. So for years, we've noticed that our patients look very much like they are septic. They look for all the world, they're hyperdynamic, they have elevated white counts, and we know that they're sterile. We chase our tails looking for infection, but we don't actually find it. We now know that there's an emerging biology of DAMPs, these damage-associated molecular patterns. These are things like HMGB1, the mitochondrial DNA fragments that break up and shower through the bloodstream after injury, TNF-alpha, other cytokines, and the histones that those wind around. And those mediators that shower through our bloodstream make our patients look like they are septic. And they drive a lot of this response. And a lot of what we're doing with our resuscitation is not just about fixing the biochemical clot so the TEG looks good or the PT-PTT looks good, but also modulating this inflammatory response. The really beautiful biology of why our patients look like, after sterile trauma, like they've got E. coli sepsis, is a lot of these mediators are co-evolved from bacteria and signal through the same downstream pathways. The trick is we need good resuscitation practices to modulate, to both fix the clot, but also modulate that sterile inflammatory response. Lots of mechanisms, mediators, and markers. I talked about that already. I'm just going to touch briefly here at the end on just a few of these. And here was a paper looking at a whole blood study that was done in Houston. And the whole blood study was negative because it was a small study and some methodologic issues. But we looked, and a number of investigators looked at the coagulation function over time. And it's a busy slide, but I will provide it to everyone. Essentially, you can see this downward trend and then recovery of coagulation. On the left are TEG, on the right are thrombin assays. And the same thing, and this won't project very well, with clotting factors. They go down, they nadir at about 6 hours, and then they start to recover. And this indeed mimics exactly what happens in our trauma patients. Coagulation comes in hypocoagulable, stays hypocoagulable to about 6 hours, and then starts to cover. I'm going to skip past some of this stuff just in the interest of time and tell you that we have looked at all kinds of clotting factors. They tend to all be down over and over again. However, those clotting factors seem to modulate through a molecule called protein C, which gets activated after severe injury. Activated protein C, when it is activated, inhibits factors 5 and 8. And so you get clot not being made, and it also de-represses fibrinolysis. So what clot you have gets lysed faster. Interestingly, activated protein C is this wonderful anti-inflammatory molecule. And that maladaptive response, what we think is happening is the body is activating a ton of this stuff to try to keep itself alive through the acute phase. The old timers in the room may remember that recombinant activated protein C was Zygris or Drotrecogen, which was for a while the only FDA-approved drug for the treatment of septic shock. Really good biologic plausibility, probably the wrong clinical use. It used to be the last really expensive thing we gave the patients right before they died, and it went off the market. But the biology is really nice. Body's probably activating a ton of this endogenous stuff, trying to keep itself alive through the acute phase. Platelets. Platelet function is really screwed up after trauma for a lot of reasons. Endothelial activation causes platelet activation, results in platelet dysfunction. You get this acute traumatic coagulopathy or trauma-induced coagulopathy and clinical coagulopathic bleeding. And there are a couple of nice reasons for this. The first clue to this was, frankly, a Me Too paper that we did. John Hess, then at Maryland Shock Trauma, had done some really beautiful work showing that platelet count reduction is associated with a bad outcome. And here you can see almost a linear relationship of platelet count going down and mortality going up. But I'll make you notice that the platelet counts, those are all well within the normal range. So something is clearly going on. Matt Kuchar then in our group and concurrent data out of Houston and Denver showed that 50% of patients with normal platelet counts were not functional, right? Those platelets weren't aggregating. And if you had that, you did much worse with much higher mortality rates. If you lived, all of the normal pro-inflammatory or organ dysfunction problems. This has been corroborated by multiple other groups over time. So it's important to note that our platelets are pretty much non-functional, and they're probably non-functional for about 72 hours. There's really nice emerging data from real good platelet experts, a guy named Scott Diamond at Penn, who's a platelet biologist, showing that probably there are things floating around these damps are actually inhibiting our platelets. Last topic, I promised fibrinolysis and TXA. This has been an issue, and here's just one slide from the Denver group showing that really fibrinolysis fits into three different categories. There's physiologic fibrinolysis, probably normal. There is too much hyperfibrinolysis, and many people have argued about what this is, but most people would suggest that it's somewhere greater than 3% or 7.5% lysis on a TEG with very high incumbent mortality rates. But there also is too little fibrinolysis shutdown, where the fibrinolytic activity gets shut down. Those patients end up with worse organ failure and later complications. And you can see what these mortality curves look like over time with both hyper causing an early mortality and shutdown causing a delayed mortality, something that we need to pay attention to in our resuscitation, because really what we want is the right amount of clotting rather than dysregulated clotting. I'm going to leave it there for time, and maybe we can talk a little more during the panel session. Thank you.